From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with poet Denise Levertov. She first became well-known during the late 60s as a result of her anti-war poems. Also today, I talk with video artist Bill Viola. The Museum of Modern Art in New York is exhibiting a retrospective of his work. Singer and songwriter Michael Cooney does a couple of tunes from the 20s and 30s. And Ken Tucker has what's new on home video, including the debut release from Frank Zappa's new line of videos. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Poet Denise Levertov once wrote, "We need a new realization of the artist as translator. I'm not talking about translation from one language to another, but of the translation of experience and the translation of the reader into other worlds." Levertov has suggested that poets should listen to experience to discover the music inherent in the material they're writing about. My guest Denise Levertov has a new collection of poems titled Breathing the Water, which, like most of her books, is published by New Directions. In a Village Voice review of her new poems, they were described as having the virtues of musicality, mystery, and directness. Levertov grew up in England and moved to America with her husband after World War II. Poet Robert Creeley published her work in his Black Mountain Review in the 1950s, but it was during the war in Vietnam that she gained more widespread popularity. Many of her poems are about the horrors of the war. She also organized writers and artists in opposition to the war. Levertov teaches now at Brandeis University. Although she's taught at universities for many years, she was educated totally outside the school system and attended neither grade school nor college. Denise Levertov, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me ask you to get us started by reading a poem for us.
Sure. May I first say that yes. I don't teach at Brandeis now. I did for 3 years.
Okay. Thanks
and
for
I teach
correcting
at Stanford for,
let's get one, that on the record.
For one quarter
okay.
each year.
Good. Thank you.
Well, this little poem, Keeping Track, is one that you had said that you liked. Keeping track. Between chores, hulling strawberries, answering letters, or between poems, returning to the mirror to see if I'm there.
I do like that poem, and I have to tell you that it reminded me of myself in a way, occasionally looking in the mirror to see if there's something I can learn about myself. What was the circumstance behind you writing the poem?
Well, I can't remember exactly. It must have been a feeling that I'd had a number of times. You know, people do sometimes ask that question, what impelled this or that poem? And sometimes one knows exactly because it was a very specific event. But sometimes it was something that had been with one for years and that suddenly crystallized into a poem, and I think it must have been the same with this one.
You were born in England and you moved to America after the war. And in a way, moving from England to America requires getting a new language if you're a writer, if you want to really
yes.
write in the colloquial style mm-hmm. that's spoken. And I know that you've always really admired the work of William Carlos Williams, whose poetry was based on a more colloquial style of speech. Did it really shake up your writing to come to America?
It did, very much. I think in the beginning the influence of Williams really stuck out in some of my poems. I hadn't absorbed it. But Williams was a tremendous help to me in getting the hang of America and of American English. I don't really think, though, that if one looks at Williams's poems, if he's not quoting verbatim things that he had heard, that his language is all that colloquial. I mean, it has a tremendous range, and the late poems particularly are colloquial with the kind of language that goes on in one's head. There's that kind of colloquialness. They're not always colloquial, like outside, out loud language.
Did you meet him, and did he ever give you advice?
I did meet him many times. I used to go and see him. He was a wonderful friend to me. And I wish that they had invented neat little cassette recorders at that time, or that I had had the sense to write down the many things that he said right after I had visited him. I always thought I would remember them because they were so wonderful, but I didn't, and that is lost, alas.
It's really kind of ironic that you're teaching, but you never went to school yourself. Why did your parents keep you out of school? I assume it was their decision. Children never have a say in
this. It wasn't really a decision. It was laissez-faire, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
It was like, you don't feel like going to school, you're not going to go?
Well, my mother had taught school. She had a teaching certificate. And my father was an Anglican priest and a scholar. And our house was full of books. And so in the beginning, it was just that the nearest school that they thought was halfway decent was a bit far for me to walk to alone. And then it just sort of went on from there, and I was reading a lot, and so I guess they kept thinking, well, we'll send her next year, and then it never happened.
Did you have any tutorial, anything like that?
Well, my mother gave me lessons, see. I did lessons every day with my mother, and I went out for French lessons, and I went to some art lessons at one time. All my lessons stopped when I was about 12, though, because I started all my daily lessons, not piano and art, but my daily ordinary lessons stopped because I started to study ballet, and I was going to 2 classes a day, and I had a long train ride to take. So I was put on my honor to read some history or some other nonfiction in the train every day, which I did. And I used to like to go to the Victoria and Albert Museum or the National Gallery and look at paintings. So, and of course, you know, books were constantly a part of my life practically from birth. But I didn't really have any formal education after about the age of 12.
You know, as much as most children complain about going to school, it does give them something in common. Did you feel like you were missing out on a shared experience?
No, I never did. I never did. I mean, I did play with other children. I played with the girl next door and a girl who lived next door at the other side, or at least at the back. And I used to pick up friends in the park, little kids that I just would encounter playing in the park, and we'd go fishing in the stream for tiddlers. Bring them home in jam jars, that kind of thing. And I had another great friend closer to my age than the ones who lived next door on each side, who were older than I. We were great friends for a while. So I did have playmates, but I appreciated my freedom and solitude.
A lot of your readers first started reading your work in the 60s when you became known through some of your anti-war poems. I think that really did help spread the word about your writing.
Yes.
Before we talk about that period in your writing, I'm going to ask you to read one or two poems. Actually, there's a couple in the new book, I think, that would be good. Can you read a poem that you wrote called During a Son's Dangerous Illness?
Yes.
And this is in my guest Denise Levertov's new book of poems, which is called Breathing the Water, and it's published by New Directions Press. And we're looking for the page that the poem is on.
This poem was begun when my son was very, very ill. It was finished quite a long time after he did recover. And it has sections which are just marked off by a little sort of dot. During a son's dangerous illness, you could die before me. I've known it. Always the dreaded worst, unnatural but possible in the play of matter and growth and fate. My sister Philippa died 12 years before I was born, the perfect laughing firstborn, a gift to be cherished as my orphaned mother had not been cherished. Suddenly, death, a baby. Cold and still. Parent, child, death ignores protocol. A sweep of its cape brushes this one or that one at random into the dust. It was not even looking. What becomes of the past if the future snaps off brittle, the present left as a jagged edge opening on nothing? grief for the menaced world, lost rivers, poisoned lakes, all creatures perhaps to be fire-blasted off the whirling cinder we loved but not enough. The grief I'd know if I lived into your unthinkable death is a splinter of that self-same grief, infinitely smaller but the same in kind, one stretching the mind's fibres to touch eternal nothingness, the other tasting in fear the desolation of survival.
You wrote that son. You wrote that poem after your son faced a terrible illness.
He had had brain surgery. Yes.
Did you think about things like that during the war in Vietnam too? About mothers whose sons were possibly going to be killed in the war, who would, like you were fearing, possibly outlive their child, which is one of the most terrifying
things. Awful things to think of, isn't it? Well, I suppose I must have thought of that along with other things. I don't think I thought of it in that particularly outstanding way, though. When I went to Vietnam in 1972 and visited a number of hospitals, I did see many, many injured children, children whose feet had been blown off by American fragmentation bombs, anti-personnel weapons. And I think that at that time I perhaps was more concerned about the continuing life of people that badly damaged. And I remember seeing a mother sitting beside her child's bedside, and the child was just sort of vegetabilized, you know. I think that's worse than death.
How did your poems start getting political? Because, I mean, they really weren't for a while. What was your first step into writing more political poems?
Well, I came from a politically aware family, and so I had a certain amount of political awareness from childhood. I mean, I remember my passionate feelings about the Spanish Civil War, for example. I think I wasn't able, I wasn't mature enough to be able to write about such things for a long time. It wasn't that the concern with them was something very sudden. Probably the first poem that I wrote that could have been considered a political or sort of socially engaged poem was a poem written during the trial of Eichmann.
Do you remember any of it?
Oh, I can't memorize.
You've written so many, it would be hard to do.
I can't read from memory. But during the Vietnam War, I became more politically active myself. I had some poems before that. They were from Ban the Bomb days, you know, when the movement, the peace movement, such as it was at that time, was directed against above ground testing, for example. I think that if most poets do write in some kind of reference to their daily life, one way or another, and I certainly always have. So if I was politically active, it is natural that some poems should have emerged from those experiences too.
One thing I'm sure was really exciting for poets like yourself during the war was that there was an audience for the poems. I mean, poets were reading at readings. I mean, poets were reading at demonstrations.
At demonstrations, yes.
Poets were expressing, were finding the words to express and to dramatize the ideas that so many people were sharing. And we go through so many periods in America where poets are totally marginalized and unlistened to.
Well, one of the things that was moving to me at that time that I felt very good about was letters that I would get from people who were draft resistors, who read poems of mine in prison and passed them around to each other, or sometimes people who, you know, just were active in the peace movement and wrote and said that they always put some poems of mine in their backpack when they went off to a demonstration or a civil disobedience action. I felt very good about that. And I think that if that isn't happening now, it is because there is so much apathy. I mean, I still get asked to read poems at demonstrations. I did just 2 weeks ago in, at Lynchburg College in Virginia. But it's horrible, actually, to read at a demonstration, you know? It's like trying to play chamber music in a stadium. It's a completely unsuitable place for poetry, really. One has to kind of bawl it out over a loudspeaker system.
Oh, sure, right.
And you're reading to
a mob,
a moving audience. I mean, when I go to demonstrations, I don't listen very carefully to the speeches. I mill around and look for my friends and see how many people are there. And you know, I don't think that one listens to speeches very carefully at demonstrations. There have to be speeches, and there have to perhaps even be poems. And if I'm asked, I always comply because, you know, if that's what's wanted, I will do it. But it really is a horrible experience to read it at a huge demonstration.
Can I ask you to read another poem from your new book?
Sure.
And I'm going to ask you to read Making Peace. And we'll see if we can find
okay.
the page.
Yes, I have this one.
And this is on page 40.
Right, I've got that.
And the new volume of poems is called Breathing the Water.
This poem, Making Peace, did start as the result of someone having called out of a darkened auditorium to me when I was sitting on a stage with some other women at a panel on women, war, and peace. One person in the audience, whom I couldn't see because it was dark down there, made the remarks with which the poem begins. Well, I've paraphrased them. And then when I thought about this statement that she had made, it really wasn't a question, the poem emerged a week or two later. Making Peace. A voice from the dark called out, "The poets must give us imagination of peace to oust the intense familiar imagination of disaster. Peace, not only the absence of war, but peace, like a poem, is not there ahead of itself. Can't be imagined before it is made. Can't be known except in the words of its making. Grammar of justice. Syntax of mutual aid. A feeling towards it, dimly sensing a rhythm, is all we have until we begin to utter its metaphors, learning them as we speak. A line of peace might appear if we restructured the sentence our lives are making, revoked its reaffirmation of profit and power, questioned our needs, allowed long pauses. A cadence of peace might balance its weight on that different fulcrum. Peace, a presence, an energy field more intense than war, might pulse then, stanza by stanza, into the world. Each act of living, one of its words, each word, a vibration of light, facets of the forming crystal.
I want to ask you something about the first line in that. A voice from the dark called out, "The poets must give us imagination of peace." Maybe I'm being too literal here, but are people always telling you what the poet should be doing in terms of peace?
Well, no, I don't think that people are always telling me what a poet should be doing in terms of peace. This particular person, who actually turned out to be, although I've never met her, but I was told afterwards that it was Virginia Sapir, one of the founders of family therapy. And she was saying that we have to have this positive image of peace and that who can provide it if the poets don't. That was her idea. I don't think that this is something which many people do say, though.
My guest is poet Denise Levertov. She has a new collection of poems called Breathing the Water. We'll talk more and hear more of her poems after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Poet Denise Levertov is my guest. If you don't mind my asking him, I'm interested in a little bit more about your background. Your parents had such interesting backgrounds, and I wonder how their religious backgrounds affected you and affected your poem. Now, your father was a Russian-born Hasidic Jew.
Yes.
And your mother was
Welsh.
And her father was a priest.
Now, my mother's father was a doctor.
Oh, he was a doctor. Okay.
Yes.
Now, your father...
My father...
Was it converted to...
Yes. Mm-hmm. He became a Christian when he was at the university. His father sent him to Königsberg, to the university, because in Tsarist Russia, as a Jew, he couldn't go to the university. And while he was there, he read the Gospels and became convinced that Jesus had been the Messiah. So by then he, of course, his family didn't accept that. Well, he taught at the University of Leipzig, and after World War One, he and my mother and my sister, who had been born in Germany, came to England, and he was ordained as an Anglican priest. So by the time I was born, he was a priest of the Church of England, an Anglican priest.
Did you grow up with a lot of religion in the house? It sounds very intense.
yes, there was a lot of religion, but it was never stuffed down my throat, and I was never sort of made to go to church. I mean, I had religious doubts at a very early age, and my parents were sorry about that, but they kind of figured that in time I would get over them. It took me a lifetime to do, but I did at long last.
You wrote a poem about your father after he died, which I've heard about, but I haven't read. It's in none of the collections of your poems that I have, unfortunately. But in that poem, from how I understand it, you describe him right before he died, getting out of his deathbed and doing a Hasidic dance of praise.
He did. Yes.
It sounds very. It was very moving to hear.
Yes,
that.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Do you think of yourself as religious now, or as having a religious streak in your poems?
No, I do feel that in recent years my poems have become more and more concerned with religious matters, and I am a communicant. I do consider myself a believer. I go to a church in Boston called Emmanuel Church. It's an Anglican church, Episcopalian church, and they do Bach cantatas every Sunday. Wonderful, wonderful music. And
is there a poem that you could read from your new collection that you think expresses that?
Oh, I don't think I have a poem that actually does. The poems that are most theological probably are the ones that are about Julian of Norwich, a 15th century, 14th century, coming into the 15th century, a little bit English mystic, but those are too long to read. I could read this poem, which is one of a number of variations on themes by Rilke. This one is a little different from the others because it's variation and reflection on a theme by Rilke, and the first half of it is from a theme in Rilke's Book of Hours, Book 1, Poem 7. But then the second part is entirely mine, not Rilke's. Variations I think of as not translations, but poems which take some images and metaphors from the original. So the first part then is the variation. If just for once the swing of cause and effect, would come to rest, if casual events would halt, and the machine that supplies meaningless laughter ran down, and my bustling senses, taking a deep breath, fell silent, and left my attention free at last. Then my thought, single and multifold, could think you into itself until it filled with you to the very brim, bounding the whole flood of your boundlessness. And at that timeless moment of possession, fleeting as a smile, surrender you and let you flow back into all creation. 2. The reflection. There will never be that stillness. Within the pulse of flesh, in the dust of being, where we trudge, turning our hungry gaze this way and that, the wings of the morning brush through our blood as cloud shadows brush the land. What we desire travels with us. We must breathe time as fishes breathe water. God's flight circles us.
Does writing poems help you think? Do you crystallize a thought as you write a poem?
Well, I have always loved the saying, how do I know what I think till I see what I say? And I think that it is a sort of motto of, or should be the motto of poets. But I think there's another kind of thinking too, which is a more analytical thinking, and that when one is teaching, when one is writing prose, one is using that other kind of thought. So poetry crystallizes one's intuitions rather than one's thought through conclusions. And the conclusions with which poetry presents one are reached through a process of following through on one's intuitions.
We only have about a minute left, but I'm wondering if you're a poet who had to overcome shyness before being able to read your poems.
Actually, no, because I had learned to read aloud, reading children's stories to my son when he was little, and I had always enjoyed doing that. So when I first was asked to read in public, I'm sure I read too fast because I was nervous, but I wasn't shy.
Do you like your poems better in the ear or on the page?
Oh, they have to be. I feel that all poetry should be heard as well as seen. They must be heard. Even if they're only heard in your mind, you still have to hear them with your mind's ear, speak them with your mind's tongue.
I want to thank you very much for reading some of your poems
thank
for us
you,
and
Terry.
Talking
thank you.
With us about your life. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
My guest has been poet Denise Levertov. If you'd like to read more of her poems, she has a new collection, which is titled Breathing the Water. And like most of her books of poems, it's published by New Directions. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with sports reporter Larry Merchant. He's now a boxing analyst for Home Box Office, and we're going to discuss the current state of boxing. We'll also look at how sports writing has changed over the years. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with Bill Viola, one of the pioneers of video art. The Museum of Modern Art is exhibiting his work in their first major retrospective of a video artist. Also, it might be December, but folk singer Michael Cooney is in a tropical mood. He performs a couple of novelty songs about the South Sea Islands. And Ken Tucker reviews rock musician Frank Zappa's entry into the home video business. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green in Washington. Five U.S. senators today praised the Intermediate Range Missile Treaty as a landmark achievement. The treaty will be signed next week when President Reagan and Soviet leader Gorbachev hold their summit in Washington. Conservative critics of the pact called a news conference today to announce what was called an anti-appeasement alliance against Senate ratification of the treaty. Conservative Caucus Chairman Howard Phillips referred to the president as a, quote, useful idiot for Soviet propaganda because of his defense of the superpower deal in a four-network TV interview last night. The 11-day hostage standoff in Atlanta ended peacefully early this morning. Cuban and federal negotiators signed an 8-point agreement, and all 89 hostages were freed. NPR's Joe Maglino has details.
Today, FBI SWAT teams moved in to take control of the prison, and the first buses of Cuban detainees left the penitentiary for detention centers across the country. It will take several days to process all the prisoners. Then federal authorities will assess the damage done by the riot and start to make plans to rebuild the penitentiary. In the meantime, all 89 hostages released early this morning are said to be in good health. Doctors who examined the men said all appeared to be well. None was mistreated during the 11-day ordeal. In Atlanta, this is Joe Maglino reporting.
Indirect ceasefire negotiations between the Nicaraguan government and rebel negotiators failed to reach agreement today. Cardinal Miguel Obando y Bravo mediated the talks in Santo Domingo. The cardinal proposed two brief holiday ceasefires, but the talks ended in deadlock over a proposal to include political issues in the ceasefire agreement. The Sandinistas have suggested a new round of talks later this month. 2 days of peace talks aimed at ending the civil war in Cambodia, that's Kampuchea, ended today in France. Both sides say they have made progress in the unprecedented conference. Details from Simon Long.
Taking part has been, on the one hand, Kampuchea's former king, Prince Sihanouk, who now heads a resistance coalition government. Facing him across the table has been Hun Sen, prime minister of a government that was installed following an invasion by Vietnam 9 years ago. It was then that the notorious Khmer Rouge regime of Pol Pot, often accused of near genocide, was ousted. Even now, Soviet bloc Vietnam maintains over 100,000 troops in Kampuchea, and in the past, Prince Sihanouk has refused to talk to Hun Sen's government until these troops have been withdrawn. But today, the two sides reached a preliminary agreement to keep on talking, with a view to establishing an independent, neutral, and non-aligned government of national reconciliation. Both sides said that this week's meeting had gone far better than they expected. Some think the key question now is the attitude of the Khmer Rouge, who are part of Prince Sihanouk's resistance coalition and are backed by China.
Simon Long reporting for the BBC. 11 Americans are among 13 people killed in a plane crash in Rwanda, East Africa. The State Department said 9 of the Americans were from Amarillo, Texas. The small chartered plane crashed while returning to Kenya from a safari in Zaire. State Department spokesman Charles Redmond said conditions at the crash site could delay recovery of the bodies.
I don't have all the details, but it is difficult because of the remote area and because of the conditions and because of what's possible to be done in a climate like that.
U.S. Embassy officials in Rwanda said the plane crashed in a remote mountain area last night, about 45 miles from the Rwandan capital. The Labor Department reports that the nation's jobless rate fell just 0.1% last month. November's unemployment rate of 5.9% is right in line with the figures these past 5 months. Stock prices fell again today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials dropped almost 10 points to 1766.75. Declines led advances 4-1. I'm Sharon Green, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Winter is whipping around the corner, but we've got an antidote. Singer and guitarist Michael Cooney joins us to play a couple of novelty songs about the South Sea Islands.
I have a soft spot in my heart for old novelty songs from the 20s and 30s. Songs so bad they're good, like My Sweet Tooth Says I Wanna, But My Wisdom Tooth Says No. There seems to be an American fascination in those days for South Sea Islands songs. And this is one of my favorites. I think it comes from a time when the National Geographic was first printing photographs of South Sea Island ladies. Friend of mine had some fine photographs he took, kept them in a book, let me have a look. They were scenes of some queens down in Borneo. First I glanced, then I danced, and then I hollered, oh, I wish that I'd been born in Borneo. If half those photographs are really so, say, can't you picture me beneath a pepper tree? I'd be so peppery among those wild women. There's very little clothing worn, E-O, and no tight shoes to hurt your corneo. Give a girl a ring down there when you propose, and she'll have more on her finger than she has clothes. I've been wasting half my life, I know. I wish that I'd been born in Borneo. Friend of mine showed his fine pictures to my dad, and daddy wore a smile for the longest while. Showed a few pictures to dear old Uncle Josh. Uncle winked, then he blinked, and then he hollered, gosh, I wish that I'd been born in Borneo. If half those photographs are really so, say, can't you picture me beneath a rubber tree? What a rubber neck I'd be among those wild women. There's very little clothing worn, E-O, and no tight shoes to hurt your corneo. You should see the way they dress for Sunday school. You would think that they just came back from a swimming pool instead of being born in Kokomo. I wish to the Lord that I'd been born in Borneo. There are thousands of those songs, maybe hundreds. Songs like Where Did Robinson Crusoe Go with Friday on Saturday Night, or I Want to Be There When They're Coming of Age in Samoa. I like to sing songs in groups or learn them in groups. I have four songs that name a person, a place, and a musical instrument. I have the sheet music for When Yuba Plays the Tuba Down in Cuba. I may learn that someday. I'll never learn When Veronica Plays the Harmonica on the Pier Down at Old Santa Monica. It's a good title, but a terrible song. A good song is Lena's The Queen of Palestina, just because she plays the concertina. But my all-time favorite is this one. It's not only a cute song, it's a beautiful tune. In Honolulu town, a man known miles around has turned things upside down. They call him Old Bill Bailey. Bill Bailey won his fame with his steel guitar. Ukulele is his game in that land afar. The ships way out at sea all hear his melody when old Bill Bailey plays the ukulele. Down in Honolulu, they dance a hula hula. Every evening, there they are, swaying while he's playing his Hawaiian guitar. Ragtime motion even has the ocean bobbing up and down. Sometimes a whale gets feeling flip, wags his tail, sinks a battleship, when old Bill Bailey plays the ukulele down in Honolulu town. Some suffragettes went down to Honolulu town. The Kumus gathered round, they tried a suffrage movement. The meetings that they had never lasted long. Old Bill Bailey broke them up when he played a song. For suffrage they don't care, there's other movements there. When old Bill Bailey plays the ukulele down in Honolulu, they dance a hula hula. Every evening there they are, swaying while he's playing his Hawaiian guitar. Ragtime motion even has the ocean bobbing up and down. Sometimes a whale gets feeling flip, wags his tail, sinks a battleship. When old Bill Bailey plays the ukulele down in Honolulu town.
Michael Cooney's mailing address is in Maine, but he spends most of his time on the road. This is Fresh Air. My guest is video artist Bill Viola. The Museum of Modern Art in New York is currently devoting its first major video exhibit to a retrospective of Viola's videotapes and sound installations. Viola was one of the pioneer artists who began working with video when portable technology made the medium accessible to people outside the television industry. In 1979, Viola shot a tape in the Sahara Desert called A Portrait in Light and Heat. He was fascinated with visual distortions and mirages as seen through the video camera. Through that tape and others, he's developed an almost painterly use of the medium. Viola's interest in state-of-the-art video technology led to a position as an artist-in-residence at a Sony lab in Japan. But his career had a shaky beginning. Viola was studying electronic music at Syracuse University when he discovered video. His first experience with the new portable equipment was a disaster.
It was in the winter time, I remember, and I was walking home with it all excited that I was going to be able to make my own tape and stuff like that, and this was the first time I was using it on my own. It was very, you know, intimate and sort of real... special. And there was some ice on the ground, and I slipped and flew up into the air like classic sort of Charlie Chaplin kind of image and landed right on top of the machine. Little parts rolled out all over the floor. It was just like one of those classic, like, you know, destruction kind of scenarios. And I brought it back in a shoebox the next morning, and I was actually blacklisted from signing out equipment for about 4 months after that.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so it kind of got over my, you know, sort of fears of getting electrocuted when you plug something into the wall real quick.
Yeah, the worst possible happened to you on the first day.
The worst possible. It made it very, very mortal, this kind of fragile equipment that could be crushed by a falling body.
When you finally took it out another time and you got to actually make a tape, what was that first tape like?
Well, I have a whole bunch of early tapes that I made that I keep under lock and key, because should they be revealed to the general public, my career would probably be in shambles. In other words, they're probably some of the most boring tapes you'd ever want to see. But I think I found that the time, when I look back on that, even though these works were just nothing more than just recording literally my own room where I live, the street where I walk down every day, the most powerful thing about the experience of video for me at the beginning was this sort of revelatory knowledge that it imparted. Like the street you walk down, you're not, you know, you don't know what color that house is next door, and you know, what, how many trees are on the block and stuff. And then you tape it, And you watch that tape, and you literally see things that you've never seen before.
So your early work had a lot to do with the properties of electronic image, but I think later on, as your work matured, you got more and more interested in the image itself.
Yeah.
And you started to do a lot of work on landscapes, for instance, images in the desert, images on the plains. Were there any turning points in your work where you started to shift away from the technology and realize that you were going to be interested in more poetic images or landscape images?
Yeah, I think what happened was, as I was doing this work at the beginning and focusing on the technology, and also, of course, at the same time, you're learning, right? I mean, it's like, you know, I make the analogy a lot to music, learning to play the piano. You know, your beginning experiences are very physical. And then you get to this point when the mechanics are sort of down, and all of a sudden you find your eyes are closed and the notes are all together and you're playing this thing called music. That's a necessary point for anybody to go through when learning a new tool. And that's what happened to me as well with video. And all of the time I was doing that kind of work, I guess I realized finally at one point that there was something missing. I mean, literally missing. So I became that at that point, I remember it was very clear, I really got interested in perception. And I figured I had spent this time learning the technology of the camera and the recorder. And there was a whole other set of technologies of physical systems that I wasn't understanding at all that was actually absolutely fundamental to the reception of the work by the people I was trying to reach. And that was how the eye works, how the ear works, how the brain processes information, and so on.
Now, a lot of people, if they were able to get their hands on portable cameras and portable video tape recorders, would want to do like their own version of the Merv Griffin show or their own version of television commercials. Do you know what I mean? What made you want to do something really different from what you'd seen on television?
I guess, you know, at that time, it's something I don't really, believe in anymore. I think it's a misinterpretation of the notion of avant-garde, and that is to be different just to be different. But I'd have to admit that at that time, that was very much a part of my life. I mean, I wanted to dress differently. I wanted to look differently. I wanted to act differently. I wanted to eat different food. I wanted to make different images. That's why I never sort of thought Saturday Night Live was all that funny, because they just, like, imitate the news. And I had high school students doing that in a lot of my workshops.
Your latest video is called I Do Not Know What It Is I Am Like.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in a way a study of behavior, of animal behavior, and then you turn the camera on yourself. And after watching bison graze and owls up in the trees, you've turned the camera on yourself in your office, and you're editing tape and taking notes. Why did you want to do that? I mean, was this a kind of comparison of who you are to who animals are?
You want a short answer? Yes. My latest tape is a question, actually. And the title, even though it's not punctuated by a question mark, it kind of infers some kind of, you know, questioning, you know, pose. I do not know what it is I am like, you know. It was really a question of trying to understand where we belong in the natural order, you know. There are, like you said, images in the piece of bison grazing sort of endlessly on this endless plain. There's an endless time and endless visual sense to it as well. And then there's this guy who's myself in his room, surrounded by common sort of domestic things, coffee cup, you know, a TV. There's a pad on the desktop, and it's in sort of at night in a kind of a living room looking situation. And that is as well is part of the natural order, you know. And we feel a separation from nature. But I was really trying to question, what is it that we are like? I mean, how do we fit into this kind of, the structure of things, so to speak?
You've been an artist in residence at least one public television station. And it's a great opportunity for a video artist to be an artist in residence, because it gets you state-of-the-art video technology. It's, I guess, mostly the TV stations that have the most sophisticated video technology.
Right.
When you were an artist in residence, did you find that you learned from the TV producers and that they learned from you?
Well,
you're working in two really different mediums, even though you're sharing the same technology.
Yeah, that's really true, and I'm glad you said that in a way. I mean, some people would argue that it's not really a different medium. Video is the raw material of television, but they're very different. The thing, I guess, on a positive side, the thing that excites me so much about video is that it is so broad, and it's becoming broader. But there was still this funny separation that still persists. I mean, you can see a lot of stuff on television today, and the same can be said with music, that is directly incorporates ideas and things worked out by artists in either isolation or amongst themselves or in some sort of, quote, underground kind of situation. And yet it never kind of crosses. There's very few people that manage to cross over on the threshold. There's a kind of a taking that's involved. That a lot of artists get very bitter about. I just kind of look at it as, you know, it's just sort of what happens. These ideas, once you make something, your idea just goes out there in the air, so to speak.
Do you watch television much?
No.
Why not?
I'm too busy.
Uh-huh.
It takes up too much time, and
But you're not interested in seeing what the world of television is doing with video technology?
Well, I kind of see it. I mean, you can't avoid it. You know, I mean, living in this country, saying, you know, are you aware of what's going on in television is sort of like asking a fish, are they aware of water? You know, I mean, yeah, it just comes through. It seeps through whether you want it or not. No, I'm not that interested really in watching television.
Video cassette recorders have brought a lot of new movies into living rooms. Do you think that video cassette technology, home video cassette technology, is ever going to bring video art into living rooms?
Well, my work, for example, is available to the home market. And there's a number of other examples of that, too. There are works out there, and there will be more. I look at the system of the VCR as a kind of a physical network that's been physically put in place in this country in the last 5 years. There are X number of million VCRs out there now. That's sort of like running cable out to everybody's house, or it's sort of like putting up an antenna. It means that there is a technical system in place where people can play back individual tapes in their home, and that for me is probably the best kind of situation I can imagine for them to have that. Like with a book of poetry, to have that individual relationship with the work that I do.
Bill, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure. Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
A retrospective of Bill Viola's work is currently on exhibit at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Bill Viola spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne co-hosts the program, and she's joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, today our reporter Joe Maglino, who's been at both the Oakdale Detention Center and at Atlanta, offers us a reporter's notebook on the past 2 weeks of prison takeovers.
Are you continuing your series on pre-summit Soviet reports?
Yes, we are, actually. And today we take a look at the rehabilitation of Nikolai Bukharin, who has long been a non-person in Soviet history because of his support of Lenin's relatively liberal new economic policy. We also profile a Bolshevik 60 years after Stalin's purges began, and an 85-year-old Russian princess, and we visit a factory in Moscow where workers exercise a kind of workplace democracy.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Musician Frank Zappa is now in the home video business. Ken Tucker has a review of an introductory sampler of Zappa's new line of video cassettes.
Frank Zappa is one of those pop musicians who gets called a genius mostly because no one knows what else to call him. Beginning in the 60s with records like Freak Out and We're Only In It for the Money, Zappa established himself as part of rock's avant-garde. He professed to hate rock for its simplicity. He has frequently cited Charles Ives as more of an influence than Chuck Berry, but he always partook of rock's vulgarity. Certainly he's the only avant-garde composer I know who has written a song called Don't Eat the Yellow Snow. Zappa was interested in video long before there was an MTV. 15 years ago, he started filming his own concerts, and back then he directed an unwatchable mishmash that briefly passed as a feature film called 200 Motels. Now Zappa has formed Honker Films, a video cassette company that will be offering Zappa's product on a regular basis beginning sometime next year. To introduce his new product line to the public, Zappa has just released Video from Hell, a compilation of scenes from upcoming Honker Films projects. Among these are snippets from a movie Zappa made a decade ago based on his rock opera Uncle Meat. Its amateurish acting and editing suggest why it never became a theatrical release. There's also a section featuring Frank playing a guitar solo that lasts for at least 5 minutes, at which point, I cannot tell a lie, I fast-forwarded through it. By far the most interesting segment of Video from Hell is An American Dissident, footage of Zappa testifying before the Senate hearings on rock music held in the summer of 1986. These were the hearings, you may recall, that brought to prominence the Parents Music Resource Center. That group is led by Tipper Gore, wife of Senator Albert Gore, now a Democratic presidential candidate. The PMRC was upset about what it thought were the pernicious effects of rock music on young people, concerns that Zappa addressed with withering scorn.
There is no sound that you can make with your mouth or word that will come out of your mouth that is so powerful that it'll make you go to hell. It's not going to do it. It's also not going to turn you into a social liability. Disturbed people can be set off on a disturbed course of action by any kind of stimulus. They can be set off by anything, including my tie or your hair or that chair over there or anything. Anything can set it off. You can't point to statistics of people doing strange things in the vicinity of rock music, because all you got to do is look around at all the normal kids who listen to it and live with it every day, who do not commit suicide, they don't commit murder, and they grew up to be, in some cases, legislators.
It's interesting to see Zappa in this context, a man who's made a career out of being a brainy freak, dressed in a suit and tie and defending music for which in any other context he has very little use. In his albums and videos, Frank Zappa often seems like a satirist in search of a subject. In these filmed moments denouncing rock and roll censorship, it's clear that he's found the unifying subject that has eluded him for so long. Other new video cassette releases include Ishtar, the already legendary Elaine May bomb starring Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman, and Gardens of Stone, Francis Ford Coppola's recent Vietnam movie starring a granite-faced James Caan.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time I'll speak with photographer Bill Burke. His new book is a photo diary of his three trips to the Cambodia-Thailand border. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review a new reissue featuring alto saxophonist Johnny Bothwell, who imitated the sound of Johnny Hodges. And television critic David Bianculli will discuss how the networks are playing the Reagan-Gorbachev summit. So I hope you can join us. We'd love to hear from you. Write us with your comments and suggestions. The address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.